Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. This study explores Yom Kippur and the New Testament book of Hebrews, focusing on why atonement matters and how Yeshua, or Jesus, as the ultimate high priest, bridges the gap between heaven and humanity. We dive into the purpose of the Torah, the meaning of true trust and rest, and how the new covenant transforms us from the inside out. The conversation invites us to move from fear of judgment to confidence in approaching God, letting go of shame and embracing the assurance found in God's presence and promises.
For some of you, this particular day, Yom HaKippurim, or shortened version of that, Yom Kippur, Day of Coverings, Day of Covering, Day of Atonement. It's an old thing. Rose, how many years has it been? 57 years. So 57 years is Rose's 57th time of going through Yom Kippur. And for some of us, it's very fresh, maybe a couple decades, maybe first time. And one of the things that we always look at every time it comes around is remembering the why, because we can get caught up in the what and the how, but the why is hugely important, because I hope that you caught that in the passages that we were going through today, especially the passage we looked at in Isaiah 57 and 58. That was hugely on the why. When you read the prophets and they go over the things related to things that happened in the Torah, things that happened throughout Israel's history, it's focused on the why. The why. Why? Why are you doing this? Why are you returning? Okay, you're going to get back into the land again. Okay, well, why were you there to begin with? And then what are you going to be doing when you get there? And why are you going to be doing that again? Because if this is just some sort of a magic charm, wasn't it good that what the people were doing there in the same place before the exiles, before they were hauled off to Babylon? Because there were priests officiating there in the temple, but what was going on inside of the people? And that's what the prophets really get at. What was going on inside of the people? And in particular, when the passage we looked at here today in Isaiah 57 and 58, there was talking about, there was a call. It talks about the call, especially in the beginning of 58. The call goes out. Okay, we're just talking about that back on Yom Teruah, you know, the Rosh Hashanah. The great call goes out, the call to turn back, the call for teshuva, repentance, calling you back. Okay, well, you heard the call. And did you actually turn back to the Lord? Well, one of the things that Isaiah 58 goes over is that, no, you still continued on with the things that you were doing before. You were still oppressing people. You were still not looking out for people who needed help. You were not stepping in to help. And yet you would then show up on Yom Kippur and say, hey, look at me. I'm fasting. And the good question that should be then asked is, well, why are you fasting? What is it when the Lord says, humble yourselves? Why? Why are you to humble yourselves? What is it that heaven is actually looking for on this? So some key things to remember here is that the creator of heaven and earth wants to be at one, wants to live with us. The dwelling place of heaven wants to be amongst mankind. That's a thing you see from the garden, back to the garden again, back in, you read in Revelation, and you see it there fulfilled also in the latter chapters of Ezekiel, that you see this great promise again, that the dwelling place of God is going to be with mankind. So then what was the problem? Why couldn't the dwelling place be amongst mankind? Well, as the word reveals to us, something big happened there right near the beginning, is that the first humans created, the ones that God formed, and then God then took from the side of Adam, they decided to go a different way. They heard a different call, looked for a different source of knowledge. So thus the division started happening very early. So then what does heaven want to do? Fix the gulf, fix that divide. Yes, you can't no longer dwell in the direct presence of the Lord for the sake of the people themselves, so that we ourselves are not destroyed by the presence of the Lord. But heaven wants to dwell with us. So thus you see a problem, don't you? You have a problem. Heaven wants to dwell with mankind. Mankind can't dwell directly with God anymore. So then they start bridging the gulf. And then you see the call to Avraham. Avraham back there in Mesopotamia called out of a very sophisticated culture of the time period, but it was missing something. It had all kinds of stories of how things came to be, stories of the flood, etc. But it was missing something, which was the true story of the creator of heaven and earth, the true story of the flood, what that was all about, what it was that God was actually trying to do. So the Lord called out Avram into a different land, hit the reset button, and restart and say, okay, now we are going to have a different father for the nations here going forward. And thus you see that also Israel's sanctuary, the tent, later to a building, and the work of the high priest for the Day of Atonement is really showing about how heaven is bridging this gap. You see this, the gap at the beginning forming, then you see the heaven starts to close that gap with Avram and giving him that great promise that through him would become a blessing for all nations. And then you see that through Avraham's descendants, then comes this embassy of the world, embassy for the world that heaven comes down, this tent, tabernacle. And then you see that there is going to be one coming through this people who is going to be the ultimate bridger of the gap between them and bridges this chasm. And the other key lesson that we can get from this is that we can be humbly confident in heaven's covering for our sins, transgressions, and iniquities, and in removing them from heaven's memory because of the work of the greatest offering and the high priest, Yeshua, the anointed one. Because of this, you become a new creation in God's eyes. And why is this important? Because, yes, there is the customary phrase, you know, may you be inscribed in the book of life for another year. But what is the message actually of the word? The message of the word is the one who has the book of life will inscribe you in it. And you can be confident that you are actually there, but not because of your own confidence, putting your confidence in yourself, but in the confidence you have in what? God's ways. In other words, the Messiah, in other words, Yeshua. So this day, thus, is an anniversary of Yeshua's covering work. So thus, it came up here recently that when I was talking with someone there who was kind of rediscovering Yom Kippur and all of the things of God and happened to be going through the great book of Hebrews. Now, Hebrews, we read just two chapters of it today, Hebrews 9 and 10. But Hebrews really is a huge work that focuses on what it is that Yeshua's role forms in here and how we can truly be confident. You know, I come from a tradition where there was a time that was actually keyed off of the Day of Atonement, that you basically, when that time came, you would have to sit trembling in fear because you never knew when your name would come up and would you have heaven's covering or not. So you were always quaking in fear for when your name came up and whether you would actually be covered or not. But we have read just a passage here And we'll be going into a little bit more detail on this, but Hebrews 9 and 10 is a part of a message that says, okay, you know Yom Kippur? That is a heavenly practice of something that heaven is doing here. And a key part of that is you can be confident of the one who takes you in to the Holy of Holies, who takes you in by a blood that has true and everlasting importance and covering. That is not a covering that is required each year. And each year you must be in fear for wondering, well, will it be covered this year or not? That is a huge part of what this letter of Hebrews is all about. So we see a hint of it, of what this letter is all about, that it's really about the high priest. And it really kicks off from chapter 4 and continues on really through chapter 10, but really even continues on even through the end of the letter. But really, chapters 4 through chapter 10 of Hebrews, about what the high priest is doing and why you even have a high priest. But one of the things you'll see some people will say that, and we'll get to a little bit that of when we get up to chapters 9 especially, that, well, you know, this is talking about a replacement. You know, you have the replacement priesthood comes in, and so everything else is obsolete and left behind. Well, then, what then is the writer of this letter appealing to when he says, well, isn't it written in the law by two or three witnesses, you can be put to death? If those things are obsolete, then what is this writer appealing to? Then we see later on in chapter 12, he's appealing to, okay, you've got the great city of the king. You've got this great temple. Well, then how much more then is the dwelling place of God really going to kick things in the world? So let's move on here a little bit and just a wee overview. I really encourage you to sit down, just like with the letter to the Romans, read the whole thing in one sitting. If you can, try to sit down and read the whole thing in one sitting. You know, if you got questions or whatever, mark them, come back to them. But just read the whole thing through, because what you're seeing is one thought from beginning to end. And the same thing is also happening here in Hebrews. It is one thought going from beginning to end, because you see things that are brought up in the beginning that are also brought up near the end. And one of the things you see in the beginning is this is a message saying in Hebrews 1 and 2 that heaven's ultimate prophet, there have been many prophets that have come before, but there is the ultimate prophet, the ultimate ministering spirit that heaven has sent. And you see in Hebrews 2:9, it says, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God, he may taste death for everyone. Well, hasn't everybody died? I mean, everybody dies. As they say, life is a terminal illness, as the old saying goes. Well, then what is this death really talking about? You see a hint of that there in the in Revelation when it talks about the second death, that where those that are really battling against heaven, that are in that level of iniquity, they're rebellion against heaven. It says they are thrown into the lake of fire. And with the Hasatan and all of the cohort, the basically Satan Inc. thrown in, all burned up together. Kind of a hint there of like Sodom and Gomorrah, where the whole metropolitan area just goes up. The whole system right around it goes up together. And it says that is the second death. So, one of the things that we have confidence in is that with the Mashiach, that's not our destiny. If we put our trust in the Mashiach, that is not our destiny. That death will never be ours. And it continues on here in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. And that's something you see that the Apostle Paul gets at in Romans as well, this fear of death, that we get sucked into this sort of sense, fear of death, fear of judgment, yes, but also fear of mortality, which plays itself out in YOLO, you know, you only live once. So then just go through life with your accelerator bolted to the floor and just yeehaw right over the cliff, full speed, just go for it, because YOLO. So why not just go for everything there? But that in and of itself is a response to fear of death. It is a sense of, you know, it came to be given the great, wonderful world of nihilism or nihilism, the idea of nothingness. So you basically obsess about nothingness, which is a form of fear of death, where you are so enamored by it and you could say spooked, fear of it, that you then obsess upon it and revel in it. So one of the lessons that we have is, you know, just as the testimony of the true prophets that we have and the spirit of all of those messengers was trustworthy, so is the testimony of Yeshua. So Hebrews 3 and 4. And Hebrews 3 and 4, especially chapter 3, goes over a lot of quotations there from Psalm 95. But the punchline of it all is that Yeshua is heaven's ultimate deliverer, the ultimate rest. This is why these two chapters here is a good reason why you should sit down and read it in one sitting. Because if you don't kind of catch the flow of what's going on here, you're going to... A lot of people then misconstrue what shows up in Hebrews 4 when it starts talking about, well, there exists a Sabbath rest for all believers. Well, it's building on what was in chapter 3. So one of the things that you see there in Hebrews 3, verse 1, says, consider Yeshua the apostle and high priest of our confession. But one of the things that you see in the context of all this is that the passage in Psalm 95, as I swore in my wrath, they would not enter my rest. And thus, you see also here in these two chapters, it talking about trust. Did they have trust to enter into the land? You remember the whole thing with the spies? They sent the 12 spies in, 10 gave a bad report, 2 gave the, yeah, the Lord's got this, trust him. So then what? They followed the 10 and said, oh, no, we can't do this. There's no way we can do this. So one of the things that you have is that where are you? You see this faith, trust, is equated to rest. So do you have the trust that the one who, in this case, in the historical allusion that's going through in this particular passage, do you trust that the one who took you out of the land of bondage, the one that took you out of the house of bondage, of slavery, he will take you into the land, that you can trust him to take you in? It's very similar to what we were talking about before, going into the Holy of Holies with confidence. Because if you go in on your own volition, what is the warning that's given? You will die. You can't just go in anytime you want to. You can't just waltz into God's presence. There is a gulf that needs to be bridged. Similarly, when Israel is getting ready to go into the land, you could think on your own accord, can you go into the land? That was the assessment of the 10 spies. Oh, walls too high, people too big. Nope, can't do it. But the Lord's saying, will you trust me? But you trust that the one who took you out will take you in, will take you back to the land which was promised to the forefathers to begin with. And that allusion there in Psalm 95, which is quoted over and over again in Hebrews chapter 3, it's almost like the writer is saying, hello, knocking on your head, going, hey, you paying attention here to what's going on with this? I swore in my wrath they would not enter my rest. It's talking about back to Israel entering into the land. And that was all based on what? Faith, trust. Trust in the one who did all the wonders, who brought Mitzrayim, brought Egypt to its knees, basically took down a major superpower to take out Israel. Well, then take Israel into the land. Took Israel through the sea, took Israel out with all the plagues, was then also going to be able to deal with the walls and the giants. And you see as a, kind of the layers as you go back on Hebrews chapter 3 is that it quotes from Psalm 95, and Psalm 95 has a lot of allusions or references to Exodus 17 with that idea of Massah and Meribah. Meribah, the place of strife, Massah, the place of testing. And one of the punchlines from there in Exodus 17:7, is God with us or not? That is a question that we can also ask when we get, when you're thinking of yourself approaching the Holy of Holies. Is God with me or not? Because if you go in and God is not with you, what happens? Yeah, you have an example there in Leviticus chapter 10. If you try to approach God's presence and you're not invited, there's a very terrible thing that happens to you. The giver of life, you know, takes the life from you. So one of the things that we see is that this question of what happens if you have a physical temple or not was a key question for the time period when this letter was written. And various people take stabs at when it was written, but the general consensus is somewhere around AD 50 to AD 60, maybe 60, mid-60s, and maybe up to 65, 66, which would be within just a few years of AD 70 when you see the Romans came in and took down the temple. And as you see from history, the so-called handwriting was on the wall already for what Rome was going to be doing. But the question is, with all of this, is the Lord with us or not? Is the Lord with us or not? Is the Lord with us or not? And we can ask the same thing here on Yom Kippur. Is the Lord with us or not? Do we have to quake in fear as to whether the Lord is with us or not? That is a part of the confidence, not arrogance, but confidence that we can have with the trust in the one who is taking us in to the kingdom of God. Just like ancient Israel had trust that the one who took them into the land would also be with them. Rose, yes, you have a comment or a question? I'll also turn the coin over and...
and ask, are we with God or not?
Yes.
I'm concerned. I know that God is always there, but I have to confess in my own life, am I always with God every minute of the day? And I'm going to have to say no. But God is faithful, and I know he's there.
You know, what is my presence going to be with you, and under what terms? And you see that in particular there at the mountain, where you see the great rebellion at Mount Sinai. And it says, hey, you know, I'm not going to always dwell with you. I'm not going to always dwell with you, but I am going to send, you know, representative to be with you, but I myself cannot be in the midst of your muck and mire. Yes, John, you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, a question that came up for me while you were talking is why didn't Moses and Joshua and Caleb just go and take whoever wanted to come with them and leave the rest behind? Was it a democracy or...
Well, it was a good question. Basically, they said, okay, well, you guys don't want to go. You don't want to go into the land. But one of the things you see a hint of that is back there on the mountain, where you see that Moshe intercedes for the people. Moshe intercedes for the people. And it's because the Lord was basically saying almost what you were talking about there. All right, Moshe, you're with me. Let's just start over. And just forget all these other people who don't get it. And let's just start over with you. But you see, Moshe appeals and intercedes for the people and says, hey, when talking about the book of life, he's saying, blot me out of your book. If you're going to blot them out, blot me out also. Blot me out also. So thus you see, and what that is a very interesting question you bring up in that in the end, Moshe didn't go in the midst of really struggling and wrestling with the people. And in that final case of, you know, saying, you know, you rebels are, and saying, you know, do you want me to take you in? And I was like, no, you forget who's actually in charge. Forget who is actually in charge. Who is actually going to take the people in? Who actually was the one who was the source of water from the rock? Was it just because of your stick was just had such a great properties to it that it made the water come out? Or is it the one who is the water of life made the water come out of the rock? So as you see on Hebrews 4 going into 5, we get introduced to Yeshua as the ultimate priest, and compared also to Aharon and to Melchizedek. And in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 10, it talks about this. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And one of the interesting things going on under the hood you'll see throughout the book of Hebrews is more often than not, the word that's translated in English as perfect is the Greek verb of telos. Telos, you might recognize that one, where it's from the passage where you see in Paul's letters says that Mashiach or Christ is the end of the law. That's the same verb. It's a noun form in that case, but it is the telos of the law, the goal of the law, where it is leading to. So when you see throughout Hebrews and talks about being made perfect, perfect, make perfect, it is the verb form of this, teleos. So taking it to its destination, bringing it to where it's going, which is playing off of this whole thing of entering my rest, and where you see in Hebrews 3, going into the land, Shabbat as a memorial of rest, entering God's rest, just like Israel entered the land and found the destination where Israel was going, so we enter the rest of the Lord and the weekly Shabbat as a memorial of that. Not only that he's the one who creates, but he is the one who is recreating. And thus, Israel is a key part of the recreation of the world as a forerunner to that great new heavens and new earth that are foretold in the age to come. And one of the key lessons that you see in Hebrews chapter 5 and 6, and then going into 6 itself, is don't walk away from God. Don't walk away. Don't be like Israel that just had enough and walked away. And where does that come up again? We just read it today in Hebrews chapter 10, the last part of it, which of chapter 10, which is saying, hey, don't shrink back. Don't shrink back from the one who called you. And don't walk away from this sacrifice for you. Because if you walk away from the sacrifice, Yeshua, there is none other that is going to work for you. There is none other. You want to go back to that which is the copy of what's in heaven? That is the copy that's on earth, is to point you to the things that are happening in heaven. That's another one of the great lessons you get in the letter to the Hebrews, is that these things that you see happening here on earth in the earthly tabernacle, the earthly temple, are things that are to show you the things happening in heaven. So that should be a wake-up call for the people who work there in the temple, is, hey, you must be very careful to really exemplify what it is that heaven is doing. So you see later on, like Ezekiel talks about this at great length of what the priesthood was doing to corrupt the practices in the temple. So priesthood here, hey, this is a model of what's going on in heaven. So should we be bringing in any practices, any deities from some other? No, because we are working here as a model to show what heaven is doing, not what some other belief system is doing. So they should have no role in what is being talked about here, no role whatsoever into what things are going on there in the temple and what that exemplifies, because it is a representation of what's going on up in heaven. So thus, when there is that abomination of desolation, where what is happening amongst the people is so reprehensible that God has to remove the temple, the tabernacle, from the earth. Yes, ichavod. Yes, the glory has departed. That's when that does happen, heaven still has the open sign on. It is not a complete leaving you at a loss for any sort of intercessor, any sort of access into the realm of God. It's always important. It's hugely important when it's here, because we always need reminders. And heaven said, these are reminders. These are appointed times. Show up here. Go through these things here together. But if they are gone and not here on earth, heaven is still operating. And the things that you see going on that were there in the temple, their heavenly representations, or the actual forms of those, are still in business at that particular time period. So moving on even further into Hebrews 7, which is really where, from Hebrews 7 through 10, is really where the focus starts going in on Yom Kippur and explaining what Yom Kippur is all about, what it is really talking about. Is something being effectuated there with what the high priest in office at that particular time is doing? Or is it telling you something about what heaven is doing, will do, has done altogether? In Hebrews 7, we can get this representation of Yeshua as heaven's high priest, but not connected to Aharon's line. And you get the beginning part of that in back in Hebrews 5, where it starts talking about Melchizedek. But again, emphasizing, hey, just like you see that little hint there of Melchizedek, that God had representation on earth outside of the family of Abraham, how much more then is then you see the Son of God in this role? How much more then? So if you saw heaven still operating at the time of Abraham, before you even had any of the tribe of Levi wasn't even born yet, and that's why you see that talking about that, well, Levi was still in the loins of, well, he wasn't even born yet, wouldn't be born for a couple of generations. Yet still you had what was going to come through Abraham, down through Yitzhak, down to Yaakov, down to Levi, and then be instituted and officiated, that, hey, heaven was still involved and still in action throughout all of that, still in business, even before Levi even came to be and then came to get his commission as to be that one that was to be the set apart ones, the adopted in, to be the those that are ministers for the kingdom of heaven and earth. So, thus, when you see it moving on, if Melchizedek was a king of peace and of righteousness, then how much more would Yeshua be the king of peace and of righteousness? Again, that argument pattern of the Kal Vachomer, or the light and heavy. So the light form of this is, hey, you've got this representation in history that's recorded in the Bible of Melchizedek. You know, he is, his name itself, Melchi, king of, Tzedek, righteousness. Well, then how also the Melchi Salam, or another pronunciation of his is Shalom, of peace. How much more then, both of righteousness and of peace? So then, you see, again, the Hebrews is getting at, if Avraham is offering obeisance to this king of righteousness, Melchizedek, then how much more should the people of God, with the Son of God in the role of this order of Melchizedek, that one that would be just overrunning everything and in office at all times, whether there is an earthly tabernacle or temple or not, how much more would that eternal priesthood be the one that would be able to not only respond to heavenkind, but also to deliver heavenkind, to breach this gap between heaven and earth? So then, one of the key passages of understanding Hebrews 7 through 10, it can be found in Hebrews chapter 7, verses 11 and 12. Now, if perfection, there you go, there's that teleos again, if reaching your goal, reaching where it's going, was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it, the people received the law, what further need would there be for another priest to arise in the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aharon? For when the priesthood was changed, of necessity, there takes place a change of law also. Because one of the things that you saw when the change of law is, there was a change of law from Melchizedek-esque priests to the Levitical priests. Because you would see that there would be these players like Melchizedek would just come in and out of history. But then there was a change when it said, hey, there will be a specific people who will be officiating. Kind of similar to where, you know, people were able, you have an altar and you built an altar to God, whether it be at Beit El or some other place, and you would up offerings to God. But then he said, well, no, there's going to be one place where that is going to be done. So there was a change of law there from the way that it had been done before to the way it was done during the officiation of the tabernacle there on earth. But one of the things that is key about this particular passage here in Hebrews 7, there in verse 11, now if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, and it gets on there further in chapter 9, builds up to this in chapter 9 of Hebrews. If perfection, or another way to say this, if the Levitical priesthood could get you to where heaven was taking you, what would there be of need for somebody else? If they could operate at all times, if they could fully take you into the presence of God, what need would there be for their boss? What need would there be for someone above them who has that direct access to the Holy One. What need would there be if they could solve it? If what they did there in the tabernacle could heal the gap, solve the issues, then what need would there be for something else? Would not be a need. So thus, you could see why later on you see that there is a need to say, ah, we're going to remind you that heaven has the open sign at all times, and there is one who's always there. We read that passage last Shabbat from 1 John. You know, if we sin, we have an advocate. We have that advocate. We have that high priest who's able to take our sin offerings, ourselves, their right to the Holy of Holies. Because the greatest sin offering of them all was offered. So thus we see that the goal of the tabernacle, the teleos of the tabernacle and the temple, was to bring people close to God. And we see hints of that in not only in 1 Kings chapter 8, where it talks about the inauguration of the temple, where Solomon is praying for the temple. But the human priesthood was incomplete because it couldn't fully bridge this gap. There would always have to be one after another. There would have to be one offering for his own sins before being able to deal with anybody else's. One of the things that we've seen in some of the passage we read earlier today in Psalm 51, but also in Isaiah 1, and the Apostle Paul brings this up in Romans chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, is that the law is intended only to point out when people are veering away from God's ways, not to make mankind acceptable to God. Because we go back to the beginning, the founder of the belief in Abraham, that he did what? He trusted God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So where did the righteousness come from? Heaven. Heaven said, that is right behavior. That is the standard. The standard that heaven sets, that is right behavior, is to trust where heaven is leading. Now, as you see it played out over time, that Avraham had to learn how to keep trusting, and then act accordingly to your trust. That acting accordingly to your trust is what you get with this conversation that the Apostle Yaakov has in his letter to James, where he's saying, you know, you say you have faith, but I have works, and vice versa. Well, what is the true answer to that? You have trust and action together. You have trust that takes action. Your trust is taking you somewhere. It is not just a club you belong to. Your trust in God is not a club. It is one that is to change you, and you are in the process. We're all in the process of changing. We are being transformed, all of us, day by day by day. So in Hebrews chapter 8, you get this abomination of desolation all over again. And this chapter talks about the first time that our spiritual ancestors back in Israel rebelled. And that resulted in Adonai taking the Holy of Holies away. But when they continued to rebel, the entire temple was taken away. They're talked about in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 13. So another one, we have another one of these key punchlines again in Hebrews 8:1, when it talks about, now the main point of what we are saying is this. So what is the main point? The point is that Yeshua, as the ultimate high priest of God, not only dwells in the Holy of Holies of the original tabernacle, the throne room of God, but also sits at the right hand of the Father. So that lesson is saying, hey, all of what the Torah is saying is speaking of what Yeshua is doing. And that's remembering this particular day that we're commemorating here today. We are seeing Yeshua as the great high priest, the goat that was slain, the goat that was cast away or sent away, which took away the sins of the world, which is what? That's what the Yochanan said there at the baptism. Now, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So you've got two of the great appointments of God combined together. The Lamb of God, Pesach, Passover, who what? Blocks the destroyer, blocks the wrath of God. Who takes away the sins of the world? That is pictured there, the language of Yom Kippur, of the Day of Atonement. Who takes away our sins, transgressions, iniquities, takes them away from us. And heaven, as we saw with the New Covenant prophecy back in Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel 36, that New Covenant prophecy says that heaven will forgive the iniquities, not just sins, not just transgressions, but iniquities, that rebellion against heaven. And remember that no more. So in Hebrews 9 through 10, we're seeing a bigger focus and a focus in on Yom Kippur. Because one of the key things is not what? Not just covering, but removal of the sins, transgressions, and iniquities. Not just covering them, but removing the sins, the transgressions, and the iniquities. So Hebrews 9 and 10, these two chapters reassure us that the evidence against us is gone. Talking about conscience, our conscience being cleared. But you know how it is when your conscience bothers you, right? And some people just have the shame and the guilt that just will never go away. They will never let it go, even though heaven promises to let it go. We ourselves have a big and a hard time of letting things go. Not only the grudges that we have, the hate that we might have for the things that have been done to us, but also the great shameful things that we have done. We don't want to let those go either. So we were reading here earlier today, the so-called the Lord's Prayer. And it says, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. That's heaven's math on this. Heaven is forgiving. It's letting it go. Will we let it go? Both the things that we've done that are shameful, that heaven has covered and removed, but also the things that we have done that are shameful. And the things that our people have done shameful things to us, to let those things go as well. To let it up to the Lord when he says, hey, vengeance is mine. I will repay. Let those shameful things that have been done to us be up to the Lord. And the ones who the Lord designates to take care of these things here on earth. But sometimes they may not be taken care of on earth. Do we take them to our grave? Or do we say, okay, the heavenly authorities or the earthly authorities have not taken care of what they needed to, but ultimately the Lord is the judge. So one of the things that we see in the purpose of the law in general and the offerings of the first covenant, that first deal, the first agreement there at Sinai, was to be a continual reminder of the inadequacy of the flesh, our human efforts to solve the problem of deviation from God's ways. So one of the key things of The law is to show us, hey, there are things that need to be covered. There are sins, there are transgressions, there are iniquities that need to be covered. They need to be removed. They need to be taken away from us. Will we let them go? Will we trust that heaven has let them go? And that perfection, that reaching the goal, that's one of the things that bringing this offering to the tabernacle, it's about giving it up, bringing yourself. Because remember when we go through the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, that the name, the word for the offering, korban, it means a thing that approaches. To karav, which is a form of that, the verb form, means to approach. So that offering is the thing that approaches. We approach the dwelling place of heaven and earth there through what it is that we're bringing. But do we actually go the full distance to actually let it go? That we trust in what the Lord is doing to take us all the way in to the dwelling place of God, to bring us to our destination. Because our destination is what? To be in the dwelling place of God. So lastly, you see that this new covenant prophecy, one of the largest or longest, you could say, quotations from the Tanakh that you'll see throughout the apostolic writings, is this new covenant prophecy. And it is hugely important. So when people are talking about, oh, we're a part of the new covenant, and we were talking earlier about one covenant had to go for another one to come. Well, what is it that the new covenant is doing? He's writing his laws upon our hearts. Because you saw it like in Isaiah chapter 1 and in Ezekiel. You see all these examples in Jeremiah where they talk about what the priesthood was doing. That was a problem with the first covenant. The problem with the first covenant is that those who were officiating were not able themselves to take you to the goal. So thus what? You've always needed a what? A new covenant to take you to the goal, to take you to bridge that gap between heaven and earth. And that is the great good news that we have, is that this is not just some sort of a social club that where this gift is being given. This is a gift to all of humanity, being called into the kingdom of God, being brought near to the creator of heaven and earth. That great gift is being given to everybody. And that's God will eventually wipe away all sorrow, fear, pain, and death. All of the residual just disaster that has happened from this division between heaven and earth, all of that pain, God is going to also deal with. So, and in closing, yeah, it's all about the high priest. All about what the high priest is doing. And the congregant is told to do what? To humble yourself in the midst of the process. Yes, Carrie, you have a comment or a question?
And just something fun I was thinking about while you were talking is, I know that the word Torah comes from a root that means like to shoot. So I know we've talked about it being kind of like an arrow. What if in, I don't remember which verse it is, but where it says, you know, Messiah was the end of the Torah. What if we change that to target?
The target.
I was just thinking
that would be a good way to put that. The destination, the goal, the target.
Just kind of taking the focus off of us being perfect, because that's not really part of the picture, right? But like to say that all of the Torah, you know, I mean, to say that Messiah was the aim of the Torah, we talk about walking like he walked, and I don't want to minimize that. And then at the same time, it's still true that all of Torah prophesies that he would come. So if we're watching an arrow in an archery tournament, when it lands on the target is what we see. That's what we focus on. It's where we look. It's just kind of fun.
Your point thereabouts, the walking in the way that Messiah walked. Well, a whole point of that is to do what? To get you going in the right direction. So, and that's what all the instructions of the Torah are about, is to get us going in the right direction and to be able to distinguish if we're going in the right direction or not, and to be able to discern whether the messages that were passed there in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 and 27, where it talks about if we go on sinning willfully after we have knowledge of the truth, then there no longer is any sacrifice for us. And a lot of people get scared about that. And it is rightfully scary, because the wording in there talks about, hey, if you forsake this sacrifice, yeah, it is pretty grave. But the issue is, for those who are looking at the temple and all of its services, to think that you can move away from Yeshua and go back to, hey, the temple services in and of themselves are going to do something, forgetting that they are a copy. Moses himself was told to make it after the pattern showed to you on the mountain, that they are a pattern of the things of heaven. If you then focus your attention on the earthly and forget the heavenly part of this, then the copy is not going to get you closer to God. Not going to get you closer. It will get you focused on the right things of God and pointed in the right direction. But unless you see, just like what Carrie was saying, what the telos, what the goal of the Torah, what the goal of the temple, where it's pointing to and all of its practices, you're going to miss how to actually get the rest of the way to your destination. Yes, John, you got a comment or a question over there?
It's interesting, and to think of the millennium that he brings back that copy for 1,000 years, supposedly.
Yes, and it is interesting. We mentioned this with that copy there that's mentioned in Ezekiel. Is the layout is very curious, and there have been all kinds of different ways that people have tried to render it. But one of the things that you end up seeing in there is, instead of there being a kind of a one way in, there is multiple ways into this, and they all point towards the center part of it. And that is a picture that you get of what? The New Jerusalem coming down. And what is the description of the New Jerusalem? There is no temple in it, but what? Where the throne of the Holy One and of the Lamb are. That is its temple. So thus you get an interesting picture of the temple there talked about in Ezekiel and the New Jerusalem seem to be very, very similar in where their focus is putting on, what the goal of both of them are. Because why? You're talking about the dwelling place of God now being amongst mankind. There is no longer any copy anymore. The genuine is now here.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.